The second speaker for today is Rabbi Dr. Josh Berman. He has taught in many, many post-high school institutions here in Israel. He teaches at Bar-Ilan University. He wrote a number of fascinating books. Anybody who's interested in learning about the Mishkan, he wrote a book about a dozen years ago on the Mishkan. I highly recommend it. And about 2 years ago, two, 3 years ago, he wrote a book called Created Equal. It was nominated for the National Jewish Book Award, right? A fascinating book looking at at some of the fundamental ethics within the Torah, and comparing them to what else existed in that time period. Rabbi Berman has been here a number of times in the past. We are very delighted that he is able to come today. And with no further ado.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Grummet. Rabbi Tai, I want to take... and Rabbi Zussman, right? my former roommate.
I didn't see you.
You're Nechla Ben Akelim.
Okay, this is
a double explanation. They are
not Akelim.
Okay. But also, I want to take the opportunity this afternoon to speak about Talmud Torah from a different angle. From the angle of understanding Chumash in ancient Near Eastern context. What I'm going to speak about this afternoon is material from a book that Rabbi Grummet mentioned. And when I say to study Chumash in ancient Near Eastern context, to try to understand the spirit of the times and what the Torah has to say and how some of the things in the Torah might even make more sense to us when we understand what was going on in the ancient world, I want to explain hashkafically a few things in advance. Often when that idea is put out, that maybe there are certain things in the Torah that we can really only understand if we understand what ancient Egypt was like and ancient Mesopotamia was like, then people say, wait a minute, isn't the Torah Netzach? Isn't its message supposed to be forever and for everyone? And my answer to that is that there's always messages in the Torah, and in each generation, the delay Yisrael have helped us find what those messages might be for ourselves or for the particular generation that we live in. But there is no question that Dibra Torah K'Lashon B'nei Adam, and one aspect of what that means is that the Lashon B'nei Adam that were standing there at Har Sinai were individuals who were from a certain frame of mind, a certain place, and a certain time, and a certain culture. Just to give one quick example that proves to us that this must be true, take the mitzvah of Yibum. The Torah is very clear what a huge mitzvah this is. There's been a tragedy in the family, and now the brother that remains is required to bring his sister-in-law and to provide shelter for her and to provide progeny for the deceased brother. Big mitzvah. And if the person doesn't want to do it, then we have this ceremony, which is a big bush out, and you have to spit in his shoe. It's clear that the Torah holds this to be a tremendous mitzvah. And you see that also in Megillat Rut. All of Megillat Rut, really, when you read it carefully, is the greatness of the mitzvah of Yibum, and how much Boaz is ready to do for that mitzvah, and how much Ruth is ready to do for that mitzvah. And yet, when we come to Chazal, we see that eventually Chazal sort of wipe this out of the books. It's still there, written. But what Chazal already told us is that Bizman Hazeh we do Chalitza and not Yibum. And it's very clear why that is. For all the great chesed that there is in the mitzvah of Yibum, it doesn't do great for Zugiyut, you know, for man and wife. Man and now two wives. So back then they had different conceptions as to what marriage was about. By the time of Chazal, the idea of one man and one woman having a loving relationship was considered the ideal. And so therefore Chazal preferred that we choose the option that in Pshuto Shel Mikra seems to be the less of the favorable of the two options. In the time of the Torah, it's clear that protecting this poor woman, this almana, and fulfilling the responsibility to the broader family to give children to the deceased brother, this was considered the higher value. It's just one example of how clearly when the Torah spoke in Pshuto Shel Mikra that there were certain values that were in place that perhaps over time changed. what the Rambam says about korbanot. I'm sure that many of you know this. The Rambam says, well, the Torah had to give korbanot because in those times, that was how people related to the gods. And it was the only way that a Kadosh Baruch Hu would be able to have the Bnei Yisrael feel any type of connection with him. Sounds like, from what the Rambam is saying, is that it was a concession to the times in which they lived. What I want to demonstrate this afternoon is that we can turn to looking at ancient times as a backdrop for the Torah, not only in a kind of apologetic sense of, well, why were the korbanot? Well, because Bnei Yisrael, when they came out of Mitzrayim, primitive, and they were in Memtet Sharei Tuma, and they needed to have this. But that there are enormous, enormous, beautiful pearls of wisdom that we have in the Torah that we can really only understand if we understand the contrast between what the Torah is putting forth in its values and what was going on elsewhere. In one line, what I want to try to demonstrate to you this afternoon is that the idea of equality is born in the Torah. Equality today, you know, what all those people are protesting about all across the Middle East that we don't want to be tread upon anymore. This idea starts in the Torah. Now that sounds like a very bold proposition because, as I'm sure many of you know, there's a lot of foment in our own community, you know, equality or women equal, big topics. But what I want to speak about today is not equality necessarily between genders, but the idea that once upon a time, and this is what I'm going to try to show, throughout the ancient Near East, societies were very hierarchical and stratified. Think of the world of Yosef that we encounter at the end of Sefer Bereishit. Very stratified and hierarchical. And everybody's born into a certain strata of the society, and that's where they're going to spend their whole life. If you're born paro, you're going to be paro. And there's really almost nothing that can happen that will make you not paro. And if you're born to be part of the landed gentry, like Potiphar, then you're always going to be rich, and you're always going to have a big household and lots of slaves. There's almost nothing that can happen to change that. And if you're a nothing slave, then there's nothing that's going to change that either. This picture of society, a very stratified, is what existed throughout the ancient Near East in all the different cultures. And what I want to try to demonstrate this afternoon is that the more we understand how ancient cultures were set up and arranged, the more we can understand that the Torah can be read as a blueprint to totally do away with almost all of that. And to a very great degree, to do away with hierarchy and stratification, and to empower the common masses. Now, I know immediately some people might be thinking, what about kahuna? You know, that famous joke, you know, the guy walks into shul and he says, Rabbi, I'd like you to make me a Kohen. And the rabbi says, oh, my dear sir, I'd love to do anything for you, I'm your rabbi, but I can't make you a Kohen. And he comes back the next day and he says, Rabbi, please make me a Kohen. Rabbi Zussman can't relate to this. And he says, I'm sorry, I just can't make you a Kohen. And the third day he comes back and he says, tell me, dear sir, why is it so important to you to be a Kohen? And he says, well, my father was a Kohen and my grandfather was a Kohen, and so I want to be a Kohen too. Everyone knew that. I could have just said joke number three and you all would have known that. But that seems to strike home the idea that, no, hierarchy is really a big part of what we do. If you're a Kohen, you're a Kohen. There's nothing we can do to Rabbi Zussman to make him not a Kohen. And there's nothing we can do to me to make me a Kohen. I'll get back to that. I've registered that. But now let's have a look. I want to show how the Torah redoes society and gives us a blueprint for something that empowers the common masses at the expense of all the others who used to have power elsewhere in the ancient world. I want to show that in political office, the Torah's idea of political office, vis-a-vis what was going on elsewhere. I want to show it in economic policy of the Torah. The Torah has an economic plan. I want to show it in how the Torah relates to technologies of communication. I'll explain what that is when we get to it. And then finally, even the basic theology of the Torah itself. Let's start with political office. Political office. Well, we all know that the Torah tells us about a king, right? And we all know that the Torah places limitations on what a king can do, right? Lo yarbelo nashim, lo yarbelo susim. Women and horses are two distinct things, yes? And kesef v'zahav, lo yarbelo. I want to talk about each of these three Isurim. I suspect that if you've learned that parsha of Melech in Dvarim Yud Zayin, the classical explanation of that is that these Isurim are basically for religious reasons. Lo yarbelo nashim? Well, we don't want to happen to the king what happened to Shlomo Melech. He had all those wives. And we don't want him to have a lot of susim, because then, what are susim for in the ancient world? It's for armies, and then he'll become very caught up with his prestige as a military leader. And kesef is a havloyer belo, because we don't want a Qaddafi, so we won't have a Qaddafi. But we don't want a Qaddafi, right? We just want to have, you know, a guy who's like focused on leading and on ruchnius and not too much materialism. All that's true. But there is another aspect to each of these three Isurim, which has to do with breaking down hierarchy and stratification. Let's take each of those three Isurim. Lo yarbelo susim. If you have a lot of susim, it's not to do equestrian events. It's to go out to war. And what we know from all sorts of ancient sources, and even from the Tanakh itself, is that a culture that has a military that has horses, which is to say that it has chariots, which is to say that it has enormous firepower. When an army has horses and chariots, this is the ancient equivalent of the modern tank. That is, you have enormous firepower, because think of it, if you're just a foot soldier, then you have to carry all your stuff, which means nothing can be too big or too heavy. It means you have a little toy pistol of a gold medal. But if you have a chariot, then you have this big, big, you know, crossbow, and you have your caddy who gives you the quivers, and, you know, you're able to really shoot long and far and hard and move quickly because you have your horses taking you from place to place. It's the equivalent of a tank. All ancient armies that had horses and chariots, the entire army rested on those chariots. The success was totally because of the chariots. And we know this. Anyone know? Does this remind anyone of a story? Do we know a story somewhere in Tanakh where there's a culture that's very much dependent on its chariots?
Yeah.
Excellent. Oh, Alice, you're doing a good job. They know. Yeah, fair. Okay. Yes, Sisera. And that's why that story is so amazing, because what it shows is that foot soldiers beat the Shiryon. They beat the tank squad. This was unheard of in the ancient world. In every culture where they had horses and chariots, what would always happen is that the charioteers, the guys in the chariots, the shooters, the drivers, the caddies, would all be a special elite group in society, because the security of the whole culture was dependent on them. And so they would get special tax breaks, and they would get special gifts of land. And so you would immediately create this hierarchy of the chariot elite and then everybody else. The Torah doesn't want us to have a chariot elite. It wants everybody to be a simple foot soldier. So that lo yarbelo susim has a ruchani aspect to it, that we don't want the king to be too haughty about his military exploits, but it also has a ben adam lechavero aspect of it, that we won't form a kind of elite of Sisras like we find there in Sefer Shoftim, Perek Dalet and Hey. What about the other Isurim? Lo yarbelo kesef v'zahav. Well, this, as we said, has a ruchani aspect to it. You shouldn't be too materialistic. But it also has a ben adam lechavero aspect. After all, where is the king going to get kesef v'zahav from? How does he have kesef v'zahav?
Taxes,
right. It's basically what the Torah is saying, is that the king shouldn't excessively tax the people. And when you do that, I don't know if you saw, I don't know, do you guys have television? To ask whether you have a television anymore doesn't even make sense. If you have an iPod or if you have a laptop or... Last night on the news, they showed the home of this guy Ben Ali, you know, the Russian that they got rid of in Tunisia a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. So you open the closet's open, and it's shelves of wads of bills. That's lo yarbelo kesef v'zahav. Okay, this guy, he had the money of the poor Tunisians. Lo yarbelo nashim is also not just about foreign influences. Notice, the Torah, everyone says Yalav Hashem because it's like Shlomo. But wait a minute. The Torah, Shlomo, his problem was that those were Nashim Nochriot. Right? And the Torah seems to just say, Lo Yarbelo Nashim, cloud. Even if he has 100 Nashim, and each of them sits the whole day just reading Tehillim, Lo Yarbelo Nashim. Why? The Nashim sit Kaniot, so what's the problem? And the answer is a social one. Because in the ancient world, marriage was always political. What do I mean by that? Well, you might know Shlomo marries Bat Paro, and that creates a bond between the two countries, Israel and Egypt of ancient times. But even within Israel, you have the same thing. Whenever, in the ancient frame of mind, marriage is not about love. Marriage is about uniting two groups, two tribes. I'll just give you a hint, a modern example of this. They say that one of the secrets of Saddam Hussein's power in Iraq was not just that he was ruthless, though that held for a little while, but that he was very careful that all of his cousins, his immediate family, would marry into all of the major chiefs of the tribes in Iraq. Why? What does that do? Well, the moment that you've married someone from your family to the head of this tribe, you have what we call in Hebrew sheket tasiyati. You now have a yes man because now he's close to you and you guys help each other. And now I don't have to worry about that whole tribe because we're married. And so he married off his cousins and his immediate family to all the influential tribe heads in the whole of Iraq. And that's how he got all the main people to be together with him. If the king, marbeh b'nashim, then essentially what we're going to have is a country of yes men. That is to say, everyone is going to be connected to him, and he is going to be in control of everybody. And so therefore, we don't want him to have too much power by having married into all the right families throughout Israel. And so each of these three Isurim has a Ruchani aspect, but also has an aspect of making sure that there isn't too much power up at top, and that we're not creating an elite of charioteers in the middle. But you know, when you look at the ancient Near East and what kings did there, then you realize that what the Torah has to say about Melucha is far, far more than the seven psukim that are there in Dvarim Perek Yud Zayin. Where else does the Torah talk about Melech?
Well,
the Torah. And the answer is in many places, but it's between the lines. Let me explain what I mean by that. When we look at what kings did in the ancient world, we can list about three main things that they did. And then you come back to the Torah and you see, hey, the king doesn't do any of these things. We've dug up a lot of stuff about kings in the ancient world. The two big things that they did were, one, fight, lead the army out into battle, conquest new areas for the gods. That's the main thing. We have all these things on these clay tablets. They're always schwitzing about how I did this and I did that and I conquered this for Baal and this for El and this for the Melech, for the god Ashur, and on and on and on and on. And here, and I chopped their heads off and chopped their this off. I won't go into details, but they chopped off. You can imagine. That's what it says. Now, the Torah talks about this too. You know where? Sefer Dvarim. All of Sefer Dvarim is about Kibush Haaretz. Over and over. All of Perek Chaf in Sefer Dvarim is details about preparing for Kibush Haaretz. Who do you have there? Oh, who don't you have there? You have the Kohen Mashuach Milcham. You have the Ktsinim. You have the Shotrim. You have the Dinim about what the simple soldier is supposed to do. There's only one person who's not mentioned in all of these preparations about Kibush Haaretz. And that's the Melech. The Melech is nowhere mentioned in a kibush capacity. In fact, it's even more than that. It's not just, well, it's obvious he's going to... No, it's obvious that he... Oh, this is not a chumash. I see. I need a chumash. Chumash? Oh, this is what I'm looking for. Okay. It's something we kind of skip over when we're learning the din of Melech, but the Torah is very clear about the role of the Melech in kibush haaretz. And this is what it says. It says... Ki tavo la'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach v'irisha v'yashavta ba v'amarta asima alai melech k'chol agoyim asher svivotai. When are we allowed to ask for a melech? Only after v'irisha v'yashavta ba. That's totally counterintuitive. We would have thought, well, you need to have a melech to do kibush haaretz. And the Torah tells us, Chakir, we don't want to say, like they say in America, that George Washington is the father of this nation because he was the general that led the Revolutionary War. No, do Kibush Haaretz, and then if you want to have a Melech, maybe you can have a Melech. We totally X out the Melech from anything having to do with Kibush Haaretz. So when I say that the Torah speaks about Melech more than just this Sukkim, it's all the places that it talks about Kibush, where the Melech isn't mentioned, where that's the main thing the kings do everywhere else in the ancient Near East. The other thing the kings do in the ancient Near East
when they're not busy fighting wars, it sounds like the main thing that they did was build temples and refurbished it. And there were a lot of temples, right? They didn't have just one, right? They had lots of gods and lots of temples. Now, Sefer Dvarim speaks about building the Beis HaMikdash, HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem, L'Shaken Shmo Sham. But it sounds there like the Torah is speaking, you will build. Who is you? You, me, the people. No role for the Melech. No role whatsoever for the Melech. And so the Melech, which elsewhere was so important because he was the top general, or elsewhere he was in charge of the whole Mikdash complex, he's out of that. And then the final thing, when kings weren't busy fighting wars, and they weren't busy building temples, what they did was they composed laws. Maybe some of you have heard of the laws of Hammurabi. The introduction to the laws of Hammurabi always says, oh, I'm such a genius, I am such a genius. And it's because the god Shamash made me a genius. And he made me a genius so that I would make the following 282 laws. And here they are, boom, 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 boom. Now, other kings also claim to do law. Well, what about our king? Oh, he has a lot to do with law. But not to make the laws, but to carry around the Sefer Torah. So that he would have to submit to the law that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives. So that systematically, what made kings so important everywhere else, that they were military leaders, that they built the temples, that they codified laws, the Torah systematically clips the wings off a melech. So that all that's left of the Yisurim, oh, he can't do this, and he can't do that, and he can't do that. And maybe, as the Abarbanel says, you don't even have to have a melech. Right? It's one of the 613 mitzvot according to the Rambam, but according to the Abarbanel, it's kind of like Eshet Yafat Toroi. Okay, if you really need a melech, then do it this way. That's about melech. But what the Torah has to say about political office, there's some other really phenomenal, phenomenal things. As some of you may have known, if you've learned these parts of Sefer Devarim, the Torah seems to have some basic concept of separation of powers. That is to say, there are shoftim, which are mentioned in the previous parak, shoftim, and it doesn't sound like the king has anything to do with the shoftim. Shoftim is shoftim, titen lecha. They do their thing without interference from the king. And we have kohanim, and they do their thing in the mikdash, and we've already spoken about how the king doesn't seem to have anything to do with the mikdash, in Chumash anyway. And then later we have the Navi, and the Navi does his thing, and he's independent, and so we have all these different groups working. That's not the big idea. Within that, there's a really big idea. In ancient Greece and in ancient Rome, they also understood that having all the power in the hands of one ruler is nishgut, because power corrupts, and then people just tend to go crazy with the power that they have. So long ago, in ancient Greece and in ancient Rome, they realized we have to divide power. In fact, we have to have a legislative branch, much like what we have today in the United States. But we shouldn't have one house. We should have two houses, just like we have today in the U.S. There's a Senate and there's a House of Representatives. But with one difference. And to understand this difference, and it's a huge difference, I want us to think about what we know about the British system. Parliament. You think, oh, I don't know anything about it. Who cares about Britain? Oh, but you know enough. Trust me, you know enough. Parliament in England has two houses, right? A House of Lords and a House of Commoners, right? Commons. Now think about that. Lords and Commons. Why is that? Right? That's a little different than saying Senate and House of Representatives. Lords and Commons. The reason for that is that when they made up the idea of Parliament in this 1500s sometime, the idea was, okay, we don't want to have all the power in one body, because they'll just work for each other. We want to set up a system so that there are opposing forces. The question is, what should those two bodies be? Where should they come from? And their answer was, well, we will look at the already existing divisions within society and give each group a little bit of power. We have lords, we'll give them some power. And we have commoners, we'll give them some power, and then they'll balance each other out. We don't want to give all the power to the lords, because then they'll just totally impoverish the commoners. And we don't want to give all the power to the commoners, because then they'll just raid the feudal mansions and light everything ablaze and take everything as booty and loot. So let's give a little power to each, and they'll have to come to decisions themselves, and they'll balance each other out. And this is the way it was throughout history. When they had branches of government, and they wanted to find a balance, what they would do is they would give a little bit of power to this group, and a little bit of power to that group. Lords and commoners. And that's the way it always was. And this system tended to work pretty well. It had one drawback. And that drawback was is that it permanently enshrines these divisions within society. If you say, you want to be in the House of Lords, then you have to be a lord. You want to be in the House of Commoners, that's only for commoners. Then what happens is that forever, because you've given political power to these groups, those groups are going to last forever. You'll always have hierarchies. You'll never get to a point where everybody's equal. The first modern system to break with that was, of course, the American system. And even that took some time to get to the point today that anybody, in theory, can run for any office in the United States. There's one, only one, ancient precursor to this idea. This idea that political office is open, in theory, to anyone. That political office is not automatically assigned to a particular group, a particular caste, a particular family, or a particular tribe. The only precursor to that is right here, is in Chumash.
Huh? What? I missed that.
Yeah, because what does the Torah say? Who can be a melech? So later, and say for Shmuel, we limit it to Beis Davin. But in Chumash, there's only one requirement. Mikerev achecha, tasim alecha melech. Mikerev achecha means any of us. Well, maybe not the girls, but any of us. That's already a big start. It's not assigned to any particular family. This idea of political office that is distinct from a group, from a family, from a tribe that never exists anywhere else. You have this with the shoftim also. Shoftim v'shotrim titem lecha v'chol she'arecha. Who can be a shofet? Well, by definition, since it doesn't say, it says, it sounds like Kohanim and Levi'im might be ideal candidates, but they're not the only ones. It sounds like anybody could be a shofet. Who appoints the shoftim? Doesn't say. It sounds like we all also have a voice. Maybe not in official, formal, democratic elections, but titen lecha sounds like, in some form, the Am is meant to choose its own shoftim. And so anybody can hold these offices, and everybody is meant to be represented in the choosing of the people who serve in these offices. These were radical ideas in the ancient world. So we've seen how the Torah's idea of political office is very different. I mean, I think we've understood things that you can't understand just by reading the psukim or even just by reading the mafarshim. You need to have that backdrop of understanding what was going on elsewhere to understand really how revolutionary these ideas were. Let's move to economic policy. Economic policy. You might think, well, Torah has an economic policy? Where? What? Giving tzedakah? That's not an economic policy. No, there's an economic policy. I want to describe what would happen economically in the ancient world. What happens, and this is known historically, whenever you have economic activity that isn't regulated at all, other than lo tignov, let's say it's the only economic rule, lo tignov, but anything else is kosher. Eventually what happens is that you have people who are rich and you have people who are poor. And what happens is that when times get rough, there could be a war, there could be a famine, there could be a drought, then what happens is that the people who are just scraping by don't have anything. And so they need to take a loan. And since you have no rules other than lo-tignov, the people with the money can charge a tremendous amount of interest. And then the people can't pay it back. And then they wind up having to sell literally the shirt off their back, or their daughter, or their land, and they're left with nothing. This would happen in every culture. That economic activity would percolate on its own, times would get bad eventually, the masses would become destitute poor, and all the money would wind up at the top. I want to demonstrate how the Torah is aware of this type of economic cycle and takes a number of measures to make sure that the average person in Yisrael remains economically secure and grounded. I want to start with just the most elemental thing, something we all know, but we've never thought of it in these terms. We know that every family in Israel gets a little piece of land, a little piece of nachala. And I suspect if I were to ask you, why does every family in Israel have a piece of Nachalah? Then you would probably say, well, it's a Yerusha from the Avos. Right? The Avos were given Eretz Yisrael, then it was given to Am Yisrael and Har Sinai. And then, you know, that's what happens to Yerusha. It gets divvied up and chopped up and chopped up, and so everybody gets their own little part. That's all true. That's all true. But there's another aspect to it that is economic policy. And that is that in the ancient world, if you have a little piece of land, then you have a parnassa. Land equals parnassa. Because you grow things in the land, and then you go sell it. And that's how you make money. Nowhere else in the ancient world did this idea exist. Not just Avos and Yerusha and all that, but the idea that we will take an entire country and chop it up and give it to the people, and they will have property rights over that land, and the common people will be able to own it and use it for their own parnassa. This did not exist anywhere else. The norm was that most of the land was owned by the king or by the temples. Once in a while, a king might give a piece of land to someone that he really liked, an advisor that he really liked, a general that he really liked. But the idea that the masses would own property didn't exist. And then we have Yovel. What does Yovel do? Yovel says no matter what has happened to you, no matter how poor you've gotten, you're going to get your land back. And so you're going to remain economically secure. In the Code of Hammurabi, interest rates are 33%. Well, that's real good if you have a lot of money, because then you get really rich. And it's really lousy if you don't have money because you can't pay that off. But people will take that loan because they need to put bread on the table tonight. Supper is tonight. The kids are crying. You take that loan. But what the Torah says is, no, we're not going to have that. A loan is something you do to help people get back on their feet economically, so that they're economically secure. The idea that the Torah has of Maser Ani is a radical idea, and doesn't appear again in history until very modern times. What I mean, what do I mean, Maser Ani in modern times? When we pay taxes, as you know, we pay, what's it called? It's redistributive wealth, right? It's a regressive tax. What happens is that those who have more money pay a higher tax rate, and those that have less money pay a lower tax rate. And those that are paying the higher tax rate, essentially, the wealth is collected by the government and redistributed to help those who are less well off. That's what we do in modern times. The idea of a tax that way originates in the Torah. Everywhere else, in all the other cultures, you have a notion of ma'asrot. In fact, they even use that word. In almost all the cultures, it's called ma'aser. Same shorish. But ma'aser is what you pay the king so that he has an army. It's what you pay the temple so that there will be sacrifices. It's never collected by the king and then redistributed to the poor. So that this idea that we have of modern taxation also starts in the Torah and was a radical idea. You'd never know that just from reading the Psukim by themselves without knowing what was going on elsewhere. Maybe the most remarkable... Oh, two more things about economic policy. I mentioned before that when you have economic activity in the ancient world, eventually the rich get phenomenally rich and everyone else gets very poor. When times get tough and you can charge as much as you want for loans. What they used to do, when this would happen, kings were not happy about this. The kings weren't happy about it because when the people have absolutely nothing to eat, they tend not to want to do milouim. They tend not to want to fight your wars. And so this wasn't good for the kings when the people were really, really down and out. And so what was done everywhere in the ancient world, in Greece, and in Egypt, in Mesopotamia, was that in the first year of a king's reign, he would declare debt relief, kind of like Shmitat Kesachim. This was very good. It was very good for the king. Why? Because for a new king, now everybody would love him. Well, not everybody. 99% of the populace would love him. Wow, he canceled our debts. What a great king. We want to serve this king. It would also weaken the rich elites that were around him, because they were the ones that were owed the money, and now they're out. What does the Torah do? The Torah comes along and says, we're going to have debt relief. We're going to have Shemitah Kesafim in the Shemitah year. But it's not going to be a function of a new king coming to power. This is not going to be a political tool that the king gets to use. It's something that every person in Israel knows is a sus that he's going to have, so that if you run into trouble in the fourth or fifth year, then you know, okay, if I can just keep my head above water for a little while longer, then we'll have the debts canceled. In other cultures, they never knew. They never knew when there was going to be a new king. And so it's not a function of strengthening the king. It now becomes something that strengthens the common person. But maybe the most remarkable thing about the Torah's economic policy is the way in which the Torah measures time. This is the coolest thing. This, every time I talk about this, it's not my fetish, but it's just the most amazing thing. What do I mean the way in which the Torah measures time? You measure time, you look at your watch, you measure time. You look at a calendar, and you measure time. The Torah measures time differently than any other system that existed in the ancient world. Let me explain what I mean by that. Everywhere else, they had calendars. And in those calendars, they measured years, months, and days. Years, months, and days. No other calendar in the ancient world measured weeks. There's no such thing as a week anywhere else. Isn't that terrible? Not having weeks? How can you play football without knowing what week it is? You know? How did they play football? They didn't play football, I guess, right? But now, why is that? Why? What? I'll ask it this way. What do years and months and days have in common? Weeks doesn't fit in with that.
A basis in the physical world.
Okay. Years and months and days are a function of astronomical cycles. Right? Days, obviously, that's easy to see. Months is pretty easy to see. Even years is pretty easy to see. I can know when the sun is returned after a year every time I go to shul in the summer. Because I know that on May 12th of every year, I have to start bringing sunglasses to shul because the sun has started to come back to a certain angle until the 5th of August, where I'm going to be blinded if I don't have sunglasses until Baruch Hu. And so I come with sunglasses. So I think the ancients figured that out even without going to shul. But the sun somehow seems to come back to an original place. So in the ancient world, they measured years and months and days. Where does a week come from? Obviously. Right, Maaseh Bereishit. But now watch what happens. Yes, obviously, the idea of a week, not just Shabbat and week go together, right, comes from Maaseh Bereishit. But every time that the Torah speaks about one of these rest points of seven, whether it's the seventh day, or whether it's the seventh year, or whether it's after the seventh Shemitah cycle, what's always emphasized is that these are days, or these are moments in time at which economic activity ceases. And when economic activity ceases, then suddenly all of our relationships are different. It's now no longer boss and worker, or servant and master. All that's put aside. And so it allows every person in Israel, no matter what his economic standing is, to feel on these times we're all devoted to other things, maybe more Ruchani things, than we are the rest of the week, or the rest of the year, or the rest of the Shemitah cycle. And so it is a way of giving a sense of dignity to people. About a year ago, I was in the States, and I it was the depth of the recession, and I saw a big billboard on the highway. And it said like this. It said, Recession 101. Self-worth is worth more than net worth. And I imagine every person driving by that goes, oh, that's cool. That's so cool. Self-worth. Worth more than net worth. But it's such garbage because in America it's not possible. Because, malasot, in America, your self-worth is just totally a function of your net worth. That's just the way that it is. And if your net worth is lousy, then you feel lousy about yourself. What the Torah wanted to do was to make sure that on the one hand we have a properly functioning economy, but that there are times when we put all of that aside. So I can say what I'm really about is I'm about serving the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And serving Kadosh Baruch Hu I can do whether I'm rich or whether I'm poor. And on those stopping points of seven, we're all sort of leveled out. And so what we see is that the economic policy of the Torah, it comes together now. It's all about keeping people economically secure and feeling dignified. And this was just not possible in the ancient world. There was no ideal of doing away with this hierarchy. The rich were meant to be rich, and the poor were meant to be poor, and that's the way that it is. And the Torah seems to go totally against that. Let me just share one more thing. This is really cool. This is just so cool. Technology of communication. Huh? What does that mean? Well, let's think in modern times.
We all know, especially these last few weeks, the power of the internet. I mean, I heard that there was a girl born in Egypt 2 days ago, and her father named her Facebook. Yes, I read this. Yes. Just like I remember when we were learning in yeshiva, there was a woman who gave birth on her way to the hospital, and she couldn't get to the hospital, and they named the baby Machsom. And that's... Okay, so there are different names that you can give a baby. Facebook. We've all discovered the incredible power that Facebook has. Now, there are actually precursors to this. Because what happens? What does Facebook do? Facebook allows the enormous exchange of ideas and a sense of solidarity. You know, before Facebook, there was another huge, huge technology of communication called the printing press. And it's fascinating to discover the effect that the printing press had in different parts of the world. It wasn't the same. All parts of Europe around the year 1500 knew about the printing press. But it turns out that there were places where the printing press flourished and they were printing stuff right and left. That was in Western Europe. In Eastern Europe, hardly as much, even though they knew about it. And in the Ottoman Empire, not at all. Do you know why that is? I'll explain to you. Because in Western Europe, the Protestant Reformation had just begun. And in the Protestant Reformation, one of the big ideas was, we don't need to have a pope. We don't need to have a clergy. What we need to have is the common balabas. We have Protestant balabas today. We need to have the common balabas open his scripture, his Bible, and learn how to read it in a language he can understand, and then he'll have his own connection with the Almighty. There was an idea that the common person counts for something. And so therefore they weren't afraid of literacy. And they wanted to make everybody learn how to read and write. They weren't afraid of that. That was the whole idea. Empower the masses. Because we know if you have the capacity to use a computer, that's power. If you have a connection to the internet, that's power. And in the Middle Ages, if you knew how to read or write, that was power. In Eastern Europe, where the Reformation didn't really take hold, where Catholicism remained in place, they said, have the common person read a Bible? What's he going to understand? They'll totally misunderstand it. Let's keep it in Latin. Let's keep it in a language they can't understand. Let's keep the masses illiterate. And what they need to learn, they can come to the church and they can look at the stained glass windows, and that'll be the sum total of their education. And in the Ottoman Empire, it was a sin to use the printing press. A sin. Why? Because they understood. You have a printing press, and you can teach people how to read and write, and you can disseminate ideas, and that can be very threatening for the religious powers that were very much in charge at the time. And so what we see is that you have technologies of communication that everybody might know about, but you have to believe in the individual in order to be ready to use it. And the effects that it had on Western Europe are clear, right? Education led to wealth. This is why Western Europe looks the way that it does, and this is why Eastern Europe doesn't look that way, and this is why the GDP of the entire Arab world doesn't even equal that of Spain. Now, why do I mention all this? What does this got to do with anything? The answer is that in the ancient world, there is a technology of communication no less revolutionary than the printing press, no less revolutionary than Facebook. It's called the alphabet. The alphabet. Let me explain. Writing systems had existed for thousands of years. Cuneiform, you know, those wedges that they put on the clay, that was in Mesopotamia. Or in Egypt, they had, you know, hieroglyphics, this, right? Things like that. So there was writing long before that there was an alphabet. But those writing systems, the cuneiform wedges or the hieroglyphics, were incredibly difficult systems. You had to study for years and years in order to master them. The only people who knew how to read and write were trained scribes who worked for the kings and who worked for the temples. And it was deliberate. Because they understood back then that literacy is a power. And we don't want to give power to the people. And so we're going to have these very difficult systems of reading and writing that take years of training, and then we're going to make sure that all the people who are literate are working for the king. Now, at some point, the alphabet was discovered. The Jewish people didn't invent the alphabet, but we know how to use it unlike anybody else. Because the Torah, and the Tanakh in general, is the first literature in history
which was written in an alphabet. And what's the greatness of the alphabet? There's two things about it. It's easy to learn. Because it's easy to learn, that means that you can spread it quickly and easily. When things are written in hieroglyphics, very few people can read that, which means that it can't get out there to the masses. The Torah is addressed to the people. And so what the Torah did is say, well, we have to use a new type of writing system. We're going to use an alphabet. Anybody can learn an alphabet. And so the Torah gets written and passed around, and many people learn how to read and write. I don't know if everybody was literate or not, but enough people, enough people that it could be spread out, the idea. And this fits with the idea, the Torah's ideal of empowering the masses and allowing people to have the power of reading and writing. In fact, even when people weren't literate, they could still have access to the text. With this, maybe I'll finish. So it's a very cute thing about a word in Hebrew. The word likro, think about that word. It has two meanings. One, obviously, is to read. And the other, to call out. What's the connection between reading and calling out? And the answer is that in the ancient world, even if someone didn't know how to read or write, but if there was even one person in his village that did, and they got hold of a text of something from Tanakh, that person, Hayayachol Likro, reading and calling out went together. And so in this way, the ideas of the Torah got out. And the Torah encourages, by the very fact that it's written in an alphabet, and not in some very difficult, abstruse system of writing like hieroglyphics, it encourages people to become literate. And it encourages the spreading of ideas. So that as much as the Torah makes us the people of the book, it makes us also the people of the letter. Taken all together, what do we see? We see, going back to the beginning, that in the ancient world, there was hierarchy and stratification. And if you were born Paro, you were going to be Paro. And if you were born Potiphar, you were going to be Potiphar. And if you were born a slave, unless you had the kochos or the yosef atzadi, then that's what you were going to be. You were going to be a slave. And the Torah systematically seems to come and say, we don't want the melech to be what he was anymore. We're going to have kind of a clipped wing melech. We want to give power to the people politically. We want to give power to the people economically. We want to give power to the people by making them literate. And I'll just end with that joke about the kohen. So where does kahuna fit in with all this? My answer to you about that is that just like the king in the Torah, his wings are clipped, so is the kohen, relative to what it meant to be a kohen somewhere else. If you were applying for a job to be a kohen, you decided you want to be a priest somewhere, and you had your choice of being a priest anywhere in the ancient world, including being a kohen in Am Yisrael, and you wanted to look at the benefits packages that they were offering priests everywhere, the last place that you would choose is the Torah. Because elsewhere, the priests were in charge of the banks. The priests were in charge of the lands. But in the Torah, the Kohen doesn't have any power over money. The Kohen can't own any land other than a place to live, basically. Everywhere else, there were huge, massive numbers of sacrifices being brought in. That's a lot of good food for the Kohanim, and food that they can give out and get favors from people. Relatively speaking, the number of korbanot the Torah mandates is very small relative to what went on elsewhere. Elsewhere, the Kohanim had their secrets and their magic of what goes on inside the temple. In the Torah, everything is laid out so that the Kohen can't come along and say, hey, you owe me this, and trust me, I know. It's all written down. And so, yes, we have Kohanim. There is that element of hierarchy, but it's greatly reduced relative to what existed elsewhere. And so this idea of how equality really started in the Torah is really only something that we can appreciate. These are beautiful ideas if we're able to see it against the backdrop of what went on in the ancient world. Okay? So that's what I have to say. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to...